Change this morning. I told you last week that we were kind of in one section of Daniel and heading into another. We're going to do that today, and I'm just going to kind of give you a heads up from the beginning. It may take a little longer today. I don't know. I might be able to cut some stuff out, but there's a lot to cover, and today's going to feel more like rather than me preaching, hopefully it feels more like a Bible study and a seminary course, because I think the text kind of garners that. We have to do that with what we're covering. So if you're here in person, you're going to be able to see up on the screen here. I've got this turned on. Here's the text that we're going to try to cover today, and I figured I'd give you a list so that you could maybe bookmark some of those spots. Write them down. If you're the type of person that likes to go to every text that I say, there's quite a bit there to cover. I'm going to try to hit Daniel 7 and 8 together this morning because they really go hand in hand, and it's hard to read one without the other. It's really interesting that we hit this section of Daniel when we do, because I think in the world we live in right now, especially, there's a heightened sense of interest in the end times. Over the last few years, the pandemic has caused people to ask a lot of questions. I'll be honest with you, growing up, I grew up in the Pentecostal tradition, and you know, in that movement, there's a lot of talk about prophecy and the end times, and it was very common you know, to hear things about the Antichrist and signs of the time. And I can remember being a kid at times almost being fearful listening to some of these preachers talk about this stuff and reading some of this stuff, because in the back of my mind there was always this thought of, what if Jesus comes back and I'm left behind? You know, that'd be a bad deal. You know, and people are interested in the end times for a lot of different reasons. I think some people are so interested in trying to figure out the end times and the signs of the end times so they can live a life however they want to live, and then at the end they can try to get right with God. I think that's one of the reasons. I think some people just like the suspense and the imagery that the end times draw up. But for whatever the reason, whatever reason we're fixated on that, I think sometimes we get so focused on the fine details that we actually miss the point of the text. And I think if we're not careful today, as we enter into this new section of Daniel, so the first six chapters we've covered, those are narrative. They are accounts of Daniel and his friends. And I'll say Daniel and not just Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but King Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. Those are their stories of those people. And it's narrative. And today, when we get to chapter 7, we leave the narrative section of the book and we enter into what's called apocalyptic literature. And apocalyptic literature is possibly, in my opinion, it is the most difficult type of literature in the Bible to understand. It's very difficult. So we get to Daniel 7 today and 8, parts of 8. And the temptation, I think, is to focus so hard on the fine details that we might miss the big point. And that's what I want to try to avoid. So let's talk a little bit about apocalyptic literature before we get started, just so we understand how we should be reading this a little bit better. The word apocalypse, it comes from a Greek word, and the literal meaning of the word is to uncover or to reveal something. You know, so when we hear apocalypse, we think the end, right? But the real definition is to uncover or reveal something. Apocalyptic literature in the Bible is when God pulls back the curtain to give a divine perspective of an earthly situation. So you might want to write that down so you, as you read this on your own time. Apocalyptic literature in the Bible is when God pulls back the curtain to give a divine perspective of an earthly situation or circumstance. So Tim Mackey, who I like to listen to him and follow him on YouTube and things like that, he puts it this way, and it's real easy. A heavenly perspective on an earthly situation. That's what apocalyptic literature is. It's written very poetically, in a very imaginative way, and it's filled with symbolism. Now, it's important to understand that the symbolism that's used would have been symbolism that was familiar to the reader. All right, so with this in our mind, hopefully it'll help us take a fresh look at Daniel chapter 7 and parts of 8. Now, before we start reading Daniel 7 here, I want to just point out that we were following a timeline in the first six chapters, and now when we get to chapter 7, we kind of go back in time, okay? Because we'll read in the first verse that it was the year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. That's not the last guy we read about, right? We had Darius, so now we're kind of going back, and that's okay. So in the first year, this is chapter 7, let's read verses 1 through 8. And I'm probably going to do some writing on the board too later. So in the first year of King Belshazzar of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea." Now, immediately here, I'm just going to pause for just a second, because I told you it's going to be like a seminary course. Immediately here, we have some pretty significant symbolism from the very beginning of him describing this dream. And the symbolism that some people kind of skip right over, we focus on the beast, but right here we see him talk about the great sea. And this would have been very prominent in an ancient person's mind. It actually reflects back all the way to Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, where Moses wrote, "Now the earth was formless and empty, darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters." The picture is this primordial, chaotic, dark sea. And so in Daniel's vision right here, he is seeing this sea which represents chaos, right? So the story of creation is God takes this chaotic nothingness and organizes it into something that is working and great. And in this vision now, we see out of the chaos, these four beasts come up out of that. So verse number 4. We're going to talk about the beast now. "The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood up on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth, and it crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being, and a mouth that spoke boastfully." Now, if you flip over to Daniel chapter 8, we're going to skip some verses. That's okay, we'll come back. We're going to look at verses 1 through 9, and what we're going to find is that these verses in Daniel chapter 8 go into a little bit more detail of the second and third beast written of in Daniel chapter 7. Okay? So, chapter 8, verse 1. "In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that had already appeared to me." So this is a different vision than in chapter 7 with more detail. "In my vision, I saw myself in the citadel of Susa in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal. And the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later. I watched the ram as it charged toward the west and the north and to the south. No animal could stand against it, and no one could rescue it from its power. It did as it pleased and became great. As I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between its eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. It came forward It came toward the two-horned ram that I had seen standing beside the canal and charged at it in great rage. I saw it attack the ram furiously, striking the ram and shattering its two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against it. The goat knocked it to the ground and trampled on it, and none could rescue the ram from its power. The goat became very great, but at the height of its power, the large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven. All right. So we've got some symbolism going on here, obviously. And there's two pieces I want to point out here about the symbolism. I want to point out, first of all, the beasts. And not go into great detail yet, but just simply think about the beasts themselves. What do beasts represent biblically? What would these people, reading this text thousands of years ago, have thought of when they heard of the beasts? Well, it was very common practice to use beast in biblical literature to represent violent people or violent kingdoms. If you look at Isaiah chapter 5, verses 26 through 30, this is Isaiah, God through Isaiah, prophesying that Babylon is going to capture Jerusalem and carry the Israelites away into captivity, which this is where Daniel is, right? Daniel is the result of the Babylonians attacking Jerusalem and carrying the Jewish people off into captivity. So this is Isaiah prophesying about this, and listen to how he describes it. He lifts up a banner for the distant nations. He whistles for those that at the ends of the earth. Here they come, swiftly and speedily. Not one of them grows tired or stumbles. Not one slumbers or sleeps. Not a belt is loosened at the waist. Not a sandal strap is broken. Their arrows are sharp and their bows are strung. Their horses' hooves seem like flint. Their chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Now pay particular attention to this. Their roar is like that of a lion. They roar like young lions. They growl as they seize their prey and carry it off with no one to rescue. In that day, they will roar over it like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks at the land, there is only darkness and distress. Even the sun will be darkened by the clouds. So here in Isaiah, we have Isaiah saying a lion's going to come and devour Israel and carry it off. And now we get to Daniel. Daniel is living in that reality. He's experienced the devouring and carrying off. And now Daniel is having a dream, a vision that incorporates a lion, right? These beasts. And also, not just the beast, but there's some significance when we go to chapter 8 about a horn, about some horns, right? We have 10 horns and then one prominent horn in one vision, and then the next vision you have a goat with horns. And so, obviously, the horn thing is a significant issue. Well, what does the horn mean? What would these people have understood when they saw the horn? A horn was used in biblical writing. It was symbolic of power and strength. Not always bad. It could be good. If you go to Psalm 75, there's Psalm 75 is a rather short psalm. And it says, "We praise you, God. We praise you, for your name is near. People tell of your wonderful deeds. You say, I chose the appointed time. It is I who judge with equity. When the earth and all its people quake, it is I who hold its pillars firm. To the arrogant I say, listen, to the arrogant I say, boast no more, and to the wicked, do not lift up your horns. Do not lift up your horns against heaven. Do not speak so defiantly. No one from the east or the west or from the desert can exalt themselves. It is God who judges. He brings one down, he exalts another. In the hand of the Lord is a cup full of foaming wine mixed with spices. He pours it out, and all the wicked of the earth drink it down to its very dregs. As for me, I will declare this forever. I will sing praise to the God of Jacob, who says, I will cut off the horns of all the wicked, but the horns of the righteous will be lifted up." So in this one chapter, now this is just one chapter I picked. You can read different, go look it up on your own, the horn thing. But in this one chapter, you see a horn is just symbolic of power, good and bad. All right, now I hope everybody's probably saying, okay, let's get to the interpretations. I want to know, you know, what does this mean? Well, I'm going to give you a few different views this morning, and this is where I'm going to try to use the board. We're going to talk about one view. Now, here's what I want you to understand. I had a great professor at Cincinnati Bible Seminary. You've heard me talk of him before. His name's Dan Dyke. Dan would, after one class with Dan, I decided I would sign up for any class that he taught while I was there. And Dan had a way of telling people in the class, you know, here are all the different interpretations of this. He didn't endorse one or the other. He just said, here's where I'm leaning toward, but next week after I do some more research, I might lean the other way. But here they are. So this morning, I'm going to give you the views that are prominent views. And I want you to know that there are respectable people. There are respectable Bible scholars that adhere to both all the views. Men and women that are probably have forgotten more than I'll ever know on all sides of the argument. Okay? So the first view I want to talk about, and I'm going to give you some variations to that view, is when these people read Daniel, these visions and dreams in Daniel, and not just in 7 and 8, but as we move forward, they interpret these events as if they have already happened in the past. And they equate these beasts with certain empires. Okay, so view number one, most of the things have happened in the past. And the first beast that Daniel talks about is a lion. And so these people that adhere to this view, they say the lion represents the kingdom of Babylon. You think about the language that was used, especially when you think about Isaiah. Isaiah called the Babylonians lions that would come in. And you have this vision, and there's this lion that comes in, and he's given the heart of the man. And a lot of people say that's Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar, and the Babylonian Empire. So view number one, you have Babylon is the lion. Now, the second beast that we read about in Daniel chapter 7 was the bear. And in chapter 8, it was a goat with two horns. If you read carefully in chapter 7, the bear is a lopsided bear. One side's higher than the other. In chapter 8, the goat has two horns and one's longer than the other. And so people look at this and they say, well, that represents the Medo-Persian Empire. Because the Medo-Persian Empire was comprised of Medians and Persians. Bear. And historically, you can read and you know that the Medians were weaker than the Persians, but they were a combined empire. Now, the third beast, the leopard in Daniel 7 and the second goat in Daniel 8, people look at this and say, well, that's the Grecian Empire. And they get to that. I'm always so worried about spelling something wrong with Shannon out there, so in my head, I'm like, you know, sounding it out, leopard, leopard. You know, so the third empire, and here's why people say this. Historically, all right, you have this leopard, he comes in, he has four wings and four heads, and then you have Daniel chapter 8, you have a goat that comes in, and he has one prominent horn, and when that horn breaks off, four horns grow up. So you see the significance here, four heads, four wings, four horns, but they start off with one horn. If you know your history, you'll know that Alexander the Great was the first king of the Grecian Empire. And Alexander the Great had a lot of military force. He was the Grecian Empire was speedy. They kind of took over things very quickly. And a leopard's fast. And you'll notice that Daniel uses language that talks about how fast this third empire will come in and take over. And Alexander the Great, he inherited this role very young. And the language talks about that one main horn, it doesn't last very long, it gets broken off. Well, Alexander the Great, they believe, died around age 31. And what happened historically, when Alexander the Great died, the Grecian Empire was kind of broken up into four areas. You notice the four heads, the four wings, the four horns, okay? Into smaller kingdoms. Four different parts with four different rulers. Now, I'll give you their names for you history buffs. Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. Those are the four leaders of those four regions. And what happens is that, you know, anytime you have four different rulers, they're all going to, at some point, they're going to start to clash, right? And that this is what happens in history. These guys start to clash. They start to fight against each other. And then a new empire rises. Now, this is the fourth, right, we're talking about. And I'm going to write up here the Syrian Empire. Is the fourth. Man, enough. Let's see. There's variations here I want to talk about. Now, this fourth empire is symbolized. We don't know what animal it is. I'll just put it that way. It's a beast like no other. Okay, so we can't identify what animal this is, but Daniel says it's a beast like no other. And there's one horn in this particular beast that is just really bad, right? Now, when you look at the Syrian Empire, there was a guy, he eventually became king. His name was Antiochus Epiphanes. The name, actually, he gave himself the name Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes means God manifest. That was how he referred to himself, God manifest. He was a bad dude. Eventually, he goes into Jerusalem and he takes over Jerusalem. And it's been written, I've seen a lot of different numbers, but the most common number I've seen is that he is responsible for killing around 80,000 Jewish people. Some of those he actually killed in the temple courts. Now, remember in Daniel 7, there was this one horn, right, that causes a big problem. And you get to chapter 8, and pick up at verses 9 through 12, they're talking about this one horn. Out of one of them came another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east and toward the beautiful land. It grew until it reached the hosts of the heavens and threw some of the starry hosts down to earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. It took away the daily sacrifices from the Lord, and his sanctuary was thrown down because of rebellion. The Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and the truth was thrown to the ground. So this Antiochus Epiphanes guy, he put a stop to the Jewish sacrificial system. He's responsible for changing the Jewish calendar. And he actually walked into the temple and sacrificed a pig on the altar. Okay, so these people that adhere to this view, they say this is this guy. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, there's some variations to this view in terms of what kingdoms are what. And this last one, I wrote Syrian. Some scholars say it's Rome. Some scholars break up Medes and Persians, and they would have Babylon, Median, Persian, and Grecian as the fourth. Right, so that's the main view, that a lot of this stuff, one view is a lot of this stuff has happened in the past. And then you get to another view, and adherents of this view look at Daniel 7 and Daniel 8, and they think that they're referring to primarily things that are going to happen in the future. Some of it may have happened, but most of it we're still looking toward happening in the future. And they'll reference the book of Revelation. And when they read about the guy that we just talked about, Antiochus Epiphanes, this really terrible one, they'll equate that person to the Antichrist that hasn't come yet. Okay? And so you have just kind of this opposite ends of the spectrum in how this thing is interpreted. And like I said, I don't want to put any view down because there are people on both sides of the argument that I really respect. And they have done so much research. And a lot of it makes sense, right? Both from both sides makes sense. I could look at what we just talked about and say, historically speaking, this makes sense to me. And then I can go study the other view where they use Revelation and kind of couple that, and I can say, that makes sense too. So when you get to that point, you're like, how do you have these two different views where both kind of make sense, but we think we have to pick one or the other? What if there's another view? What if there's an alternate view? What if there's something else? I think there is. And I can't take credit for this. I recently listened to a sermon on Daniel chapter 7, and this question was presented. And when this question was presented, it made me stop and think. And the question is this. What would Jesus, or how did Jesus view this passage? How did Jesus interpret Daniel chapter 7? And you're like, why? We haven't even, I mean, Jesus is not in the book of Daniel, right? Or is he? Why? Why would we ask, what does Jesus think? Well, because ironically, I don't know if it's, I don't think it's coincidence. It's a God thing. Jesus' favorite title. Anybody know what Jesus' favorite? How did Jesus most often refer to himself? Anybody know? Son of Man. Over 80 times. It's recorded over 80 times in the New Testament that Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man. Now, where did this term Son of Man come from? Well, if you go to Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, Daniel recorded, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence." This is the term that Jesus most often used to refer to himself, Son of Man. It comes from Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. Now, not only is that significant, but we can also read an account of Jesus quoting Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. And so Jesus himself quotes this verse over in Matthew chapter 26, verses 57 through 64. Now, don't read it yet because I have to set this up for you. I was trying to be a cool dad yesterday, and I called Matthew, and Matthew did, he cleaned off his desk in his room for me yesterday so I could sit in there and study and get things done. And so I wanted to engage Matthew in this, and I said, "Hey, Matthew, what color lightsaber did Darth Vader have?" You know, because I'm not a Star Wars fan. Matthew loves it. And so I want to set this up for you. I want you to imagine yourself going to a Star Wars convention and dressing in a black robe-like thing and wearing a mask and carrying around a red lightsaber. Now, people that go to these Star Wars conventions are Star Wars fans. They know it, right? They know everything that there is to know about Star Wars. So if they see somebody walking around like that, they make the assumption that's Darth Vader. Especially if the guy doing that walks over to you and says, "I am your father." You know, that's Darth Vader, right? And when he says that to you, you're making the assumption then that he thinks I'm Luke Skywalker, right? Now, I know some of you are like, okay, this is kind of weird. How are you going to talk? Because Jesus was in an audience of Bible scholars, like people at a Star Wars convention that know Star Wars. In this text we're about ready to read, Jesus was in an audience of Bible scholars. They knew the Old Testament. They knew the writings of Daniel. Some of them probably had it, most of them actually probably had it memorized. They were very familiar with this. So when Jesus makes a statement, there's some assumptions that they're making, right? All right, let's read these verses. He's in a situation surrounded by Old Testament scholars. And this is when Jesus is arrested. Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest. That's important to note. Jesus is standing before the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. Now notice who Jesus is standing in front of. These are not Roman officials. These are not Roman. This is the high priest, the Sanhedrin. These are Jewish officials. But they did not find any, though many fault, they didn't find anything wrong, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." Now, Jesus, I think sometimes when we look at Jesus, we see this meek, frail person. But Jesus' response is always so interesting. He says, "That's who you say I am." Right? "You've said so." And now watch Jesus' reply, because this is where it gets really cool. Jesus replied, "But I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? He is worthy of death," they answered. And they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Messiah, who hit you?" All right, now, if you're in the Bible Scholars Convention, right, and Jesus is standing there and he says, "I tell you, from now on, after this, you will see," because the question is, who are you? "Now on, after this point, you're going to see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One coming on the clouds of heaven." So who is Jesus saying that he is? He's saying he's the Son of Man from Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. And who is he implying they are? They're the beasts. And it's not the Romans, it's not the Grecians. It's the high priest, the Sanhedrin. It's the Jews. So what Jesus is saying, and in his mind, is that Jerusalem has become Babylon. Do you see the significance of that? So hopefully we begin to see now that an alternate way of understanding this text is emerging. It seems like Jesus doesn't identify these kingdoms in Daniel specific to one kingdom or one time period. It seems that Jesus may have viewed this passage in Daniel chapter 7 and 8 as a type of kingdom, as a type of king, as a type of person. So when we think of that this isn't specific to one kingdom in one time period, but it was representative of a certain type of king and kingdom, I think we could understand that any violent kingdom that denies the Creator God is found typified in Daniel chapter 7. What you see in these empires that are represented, what you see even in the Jewish system of Jesus' time, is you find systems of government that found people dispensable. They were systems of government that were willing to dispense people to secure their own security and their own type of government. Think about the Babylonians, right? I mean, they carry these people off. They use them to their advantage to secure their existence. This is that these other kingdoms were no different. Conquer. Take those people. Make them like us. And if they don't want to be like us, then we can get rid of them. Tim Mackey says this, when human beings reject God's authority over us, God's definition of good and evil, when we exalt our own desires, impulses, and appetites to divine significance, individually and collectively, something happens to us, we become beasts. I've got that quote for you. I'll read it again. When human beings reject God's authority over us, God's definition of good and evil, when we exalt our own desires, impulses, and appetites to divine significance, individually and collectively something happens to us, we become beasts. I told you I was going to go a little longer, and I really want to, because we've spent a whole lot of time talking about the fine details of all this, right? And I told you sometimes the message that we need to understand gets lost in the fine details. So how do we make sense of all this, and what does it really mean for us? What's the big takeaway? When we were in Daniel chapter 2, I told you that we weren't going to talk about the dream because I was saving it for later. Remember that? And some of you were disappointed, like, oh, the dreams, that's what we're interested in. All right, well, we're going to talk about it now. Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7, these two separate accounts, one's Nebuchadnezzar's dream, one's Daniel's dream vision, right? They're depicting the same thing from two different perspectives. Daniel chapter 2, remember the symbolism that was used there? Look at that. There's Daniel chapter 2. King Nebuchadnezzar sees this beautiful, this is how it's described, this beautiful ornate statue with a gold head and a silver arms torso and bronze body. And it was beautiful to behold. This is Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And then you get to Daniel chapter 7, and this is the best picture I could come up with, but it's not the best. It falls short in my mind. And you look at the vision in Daniel chapter 7, and they're ferocious beasts, hideous to see. Now, Daniel chapter 2 was a human's perspective of these kingdoms. Aren't they glorious? They are so full of splendor, like gold and silver and bronze and iron. And Nebuchadnezzar sees this, and man, it's such a glorious thing, these kingdoms. And then God describes these kingdoms, and they're not so glorious, they're not so good. They're despicable. See, any government that is set against God or removes the reality of God's sovereignty has become a beast. Now, I'm not going to, you know, throw out some specifics, but you don't have to think too hard, you know, to put the dots together, right? To connect the dots, hopefully. Any government that is set against God or removes the reality of God's sovereignty has become a beast. But we can take it even further than that. Any individual that is set against God or removes the reality of God's sovereignty from their life is also a beast. Now, back in Genesis, what was humanity supposed to be? We're supposed to have dominion over the beast, right? In creation, God creates the beast. Humanity rules over the beast, has dominion over the beast. And now, biblically, what we see taking place is that the very thing that we were supposed to show God to creation, the beast of creation, we have become. And Daniel's response to all this is, he's troubled. He's troubled. It's a bad deal. This does not sound good. And keep in mind that he's having these visions and these dreams in the midst of the stories that we just read. He knows all of these things. He can't tell anybody, right? He sounds like a madman. I can't tell anybody this. So he's had all these dreams. He's seen all these visions unfold. And then he's put into these situations where you can't pray. No, I think I'll still do that. Right? So he remains faithful, having known all this. And being troubled, he remains faithful. He was disturbed, but he still resolved to trust God. So this is the question we've been raising several times throughout this study. How do we remain faithful in a foreign land? How do we remain faithful when we are living under the beast? Well, our perspective of these dreams and visions may cause fear because we often look at them as indicators of the end. Remember how I started this? We got to see the end times. Like, what? When is it? Show me the signs. I want to see the signs because I want to know when the end is near. Sometimes as a kid, I was fearful of this. Sometimes these dreams and visions that we read might cause fear because we often look at them as indicators of the end. And what's the good news? How can we remain faithful? God reveals that where we see an end, he sees a new beginning. If you go to Daniel chapter 7, verses 9 through 11, Daniel has seen these four beasts devour, take over the known world. And then the scene switches in verse 9. He said, "As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze." That's a new definition of Hot Wheels right there. "A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened." And then you go down to verse 26 through 28. "But the court will sit, and his power will be taken away." This is the beast, the last one, the mean horn. "His power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty and power and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself." Now I want to back up to verse number 18. Daniel chapter 7. How should we interpret these dreams and visions, and what perspective should we have? It's real simple. "But the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever." Yes, forever and ever. Because when we see an end, God sees a new beginning. How do we remain faithful in a foreign land? How do we remain faithful when we are living under the beast? It's to keep our eyes on the fact that Jesus is King, and we will reign forever and ever. And maybe our focus shouldn't be on when is the end coming. Maybe it should be on how do we serve the King now? How do we serve the King now? Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for your word that is just timeless. Thank you for revealing yourself to us, showing us who you are, your story, for giving us an understanding of how our perspective can be really messed up and we can see things way different than they truly are. Thank you for showing us that even in the most difficult circumstances of life, you're sovereign, you're in control, and you are working all things toward your end, which is a new beginning, and it's good. God, I certainly know that there are times in my own life when I have been the beast, when I have set myself against you, when I have denied your sovereignty. And I'm so thankful that you sent Jesus, the Son of Man, to squash the beast. God, I pray that all of us could live in the reality that as faithful followers, what may seem like the end is really just the beginning, and that you are reconciling people back to yourself. And we shall reign with Christ as our ruler forever and ever. Amen.